Thank you, Dave. All right. Let's see. A couple things. Before we get started, does everybody have a handout? If you don't have to use it, but if you do choose to, I do have one. The other is, well, it's actually two other things. One is, if you are interested in reading some details, sort of historical and different things like that on the scroll that we're going to be looking at over the next coming weeks, in chapter 5 of this book, which we have at the church.
That's chapter 2, I think.
Okay. But it's Maranatha, Our Lord Come by Ranald Showers. Of course, it's mostly a book on the rapture of the church. I mean, that's the definitive study. But interestingly enough, people overlook sometimes is there is a chapter on the scroll that is in Revelation 5. And he does a really good job of talking in detail about some of the historical pieces to it. And things like that. So if you're interested, figure I better tell you now. Once I get going, I won't remember Showers anymore. So
maybe let me know. I'll pull it for you from downstairs.
Okay. But yeah, it's a great book on the rapture anyway, but it has a particular chapter. It's chapter 5, and it deals with it in a lot of background and detail. So anyway, and then one last thing. Next week is the day before Turkey Day, so we won't be meeting next week. The Awana and all that isn't meeting, so we won't be meeting next Wednesday, but we'll be meeting in 2 weeks, which is the 29th. Okay? That makes sense? All right. Easy enough. All right, let's take our Bibles and let's turn to the book of Revelation, chapter 1, and then get your handout as well if you plan to use it. You don't have to use it, but it might be helpful if for nothing else it has a lot of the references in it, so you don't have to go back and try to figure it out. And then it's got a chart in it that we'll look at later in the study, not so much today. And then at the very end, something we'll look at before we finish the study. That'll be a few weeks down the road. But let me get you started with a trivia question. So what is the name of the island that John is exiled to when he writes Revelation? Does anybody remember?
Patmos.
Yep, that's right, Patmos. So Revelation chapter 1 and verse 9.
Did you miss that, Dave?
Yep.
So you missed the question.
Dave will have to add that to his spreadsheet. Revelation. Revelation chapter 1 and verse 9. We see there that is where he is exiled to, John the Apostle. But anyway, before we get started on the actual text, what we're going to do is I'll give you an outline for tonight, what we'll do, or just so you have an idea of what I'm going to do. So the first thing I'm going to do is give an overview of the book of Revelation so you can kind of have an idea of just the broad stroke of it and then where chapter 5 fits in to the book. So the first thing we'll do is we'll look at, have an overview of the book of Revelation, and I'll refer to the handout some. We won't cover all of the handout, but some of it tonight. And then in terms of chapter 5, which is where the scroll is introduced, or the book is sometimes called, we'll look at the scroll with seven seals, which is Revelation 5 verse 1. So if you're taking notes, the first thing we'll do is do an overview of Revelation, and then we'll look at chapter 5, verse 1, the scroll with seven seals. But then finally, we'll finish with verses 2 through 5 of chapter 5, the problem solved, because John will encounter a problem that requires something to solve it, and it relates to the scroll. So more on that later. But if you have your handout, a lot of the information that I'll go over, like I said, I'm just going to do an overview of it. I'm not suggesting that you don't know this, but just to sort of make sure we know where we're at when we start looking at this scroll with seven seals. So this is part one. We'll have others down the road, obviously, Lord willing. But the first thing, of course, the author is the Apostle John, and he wrote the book of Revelation somewhere in the 90s AD. Typically, this is the reason why we come up with this is the Emperor Domitian was reigning during that period of time, and John was exiled to the island of Patmos. And so he was exiled there. Now I want you to look with me at Revelation chapter 1 and verse 19, because if you don't know the structure of the book, it makes it harder to read, because it can be a little difficult to understand what's going on at times. But if you get verse 19 down, you have a good structural marker. That's just the way I would say it. I'm going to read this verse, and then I'm going to explain it. Verse 19 of Revelation 1 says, "Therefore write the things which you have seen, and the things which are, and the things which will take place after these things." So basically what you have is, and we'll look at the structure of the book based off of that verse in a minute, John receives revelation from Jesus and is told to write down what he sees. Pretty straightforward. And that's what the content of the book is, largely. But if you notice this verse, there's three markers in it, if you will. And I just call them structural markers. That's just the way that I articulate it. But notice the first one. Write the things which you have seen. So the things that you've seen, those are in the past. In other words, those are the things that make up chapter 1, basically. All those verses that are before it. So, for instance, what precedes that verse, meaning verse 19? Well, Jesus sees a picture, an encounter, in other words, I should say, with the resurrected, glorified Jesus. So if you were to read verse 9 through verse 18, that is what John has seen. So write the things you've already seen, which is encountering me, what I looked like, etc. But then you'll notice he says, the things which are, so that's present. So he starts off with the things you've seen, that means things past, in other words, what you've just witnessed. The things that are, those are things that are present. The things that are present. And then finally, what does he say? Then the things that will take place later, after, future. So past, present, future. Those are the structural markers of the book. It makes it very difficult to understand the book if you don't at least get those basic markers. So you have seen in the past, are in the present, and after in the future. Now, if you have a Ryrie Study Bible, he has a detailed outline, but he also has a very short, abbreviated one. And then that's what I have there for you in terms of the outline. Notice how Ryrie does this, and I'm not suggesting other people don't do this, but his is very concise. If I was teaching through the book, and at some point on Sunday morning I plan to, Lord willing, I would use something a little more detailed. But this one gets across it quickly for our purposes. So you have the prologue, you notice, prologue there, the first 8 verses. But notice how Ryrie has the three structures. The things which you have seen, so that's verse 9 through 20. In other words, he's seen Jesus on the island of Patmos, and that is what he writes down. Those are the things which he has seen. But then notice, beginning in chapter 2, verses through the end of chapter 3, does anyone know just offhand what those are? Right, so those are the messages to the churches. There were present day 7 churches that the Lord chose, and there's several 7 letters that are written to them. Those are churches written in Asia Minor. Notice how Ryrie has that, the things which are. In other words, in the present, there were 7 churches, and he writes 7 letters to them. But then, we'll see this in just a minute, the things which will take place after that. So in chapter 4, verse 1, which is where we're going to turn in just a second, through the end of the book would be those future things. Those things were future not only for John, but they're also future for us as well. So I want you to turn with me, and hopefully you have your Bibles with you, turn to chapter 4 of Revelation. Again, if I was teaching through this, I wouldn't be doing this. I would be going, we'd only make it through the first 3 verses of the book. But that's not the purpose of this study. But I want to just give an overview of it. But to understand the scroll, we need to understand where it takes place, because the scroll in the book of Revelation is really important. It actually is one of the most pivotal pieces, but also sometimes one of the most overlooked pieces of the book, which is kind of peculiar to me. But someone I want to read, and since it's one verse, I'm going to see if Connie will do it. Revelation chapter 4 and verse 1, but when she reads it, I want you to pay particular attention to the ending. So you read it for me, Connie?
Sure. "After these things, I will come up here, and I will show you what must take place after these things."
All right. So you see what I call, those are just structural markers. That's the way Pastor Stephen calls them. Somebody else may call them something else. But what I mean by that is, in order to understand what's going on, so you have the things that took place that John wrote. What were those things? Well, he saw Jesus, in short. Then the things that were present day were the chapters 2 and 3, which are the seven letters to seven churches that existed during that time. But you'll notice when Connie read this, it says, after these things, so after those descriptions of the seven churches, John is told to come up into heaven. But what is the purpose of it? Well, the purpose of it, notice what it says, I'm going to show you what must take place after these things. That's the same exact as verse 19. So it's a structural marker. It's saying, I'm going to show you those future things. So now we're getting ready to look at in Revelation what is future. For John, of course, it's future for us as well. Does that make sense? Okay. So chapter 4 and chapter 5 are one scene, not two. Okay. Chapter breaks and verses are helpful, because otherwise I would have to tell you, turn to the back part of your Bible there and it's about three quarters of the way down on a page. No, they're very helpful, so don't misunderstand me. But chapters 4 and chapters 5 are one scene, and it's just what Connie was alluding to there, is that John is told to go up into heaven, and he's going to be shown future things. These are things that were future. They don't really start future for our purposes probably till latter part of chapter 5 into chapter 6. But for now, John goes up into heaven, and he's going to be shown things that are future. Before he's shown the things that are future, though, chapter 4 is really important to understand, mainly for one particular reason, is it shows God somewhere. And where's the somewhere? Not just heaven, but there's one particular word that gets repeated. Yep, exactly right. If you notice chapter 4, an easy way to remember it, chapter 4 and chapter 5, chapter 4 is showing, yes, God in heaven. It's a scene that's in heaven. But the word throne that you mentioned is used about 14 times. And that's a short chapter if you look at it. It's not very long. And it's used about 14 times, depending on your translation. And one of the themes that John is showing to us is very simply this. God is in heaven. Everything is under total, complete, sovereign control. He's not worried. He's not fretting. But on earth, it's just the opposite. Isn't that like how it is today? God is in heaven. He's in total control. He's not sitting there thinking, oh my goodness, the four horsemen of the apocalypse are coming and I had no idea. He's in total control. I'm going to read you this because this will play into the scroll here a little bit. But Warren Wiersbe says, no matter what may happen on earth, God is on the throne and is in complete control. This is important to understand when we go through it, because God knows what's happening. He knows the judgments are coming. He knows all that's going to happen, and he's up there. But then you'll see in chapter 4, it describes this great picture of worship. And that's one of the things that is seen. God is receiving worship for who he is and what he has done. Isn't that what we're supposed to do? When we come on Sunday, what are we supposed to do? Worship him for who he is and what he has done. Those sorts of things. Those are things that prompt worship. So chapter 4 and chapter 5 are one scene. John is taken up into heaven through some sort of door. Wouldn't you imagine what kind of door that must be? Now, you talk about an expensive door. But he goes up into heaven and he sees God in peace, harmony. He's in total control of everything. He's given, of course, worship as due him. But now we're going to move into what follows. And what follows is this scroll becomes John's focus. John is going to focus on this scroll that we'll see in chapter 5. So everyone tracking here, John's in heaven. He hasn't quite seen what is future, but he's getting ready to. And before he does, he sees God on the throne. But then the focus is going to shift to God is on the throne still. He's got something in his right hand, and they're searching, John is in a sense, for someone who is worthy throughout all of creation to take this scroll. Now, why would the scroll be so important? Well, because the rest of the book, beginning in chapter 6, all unfolds based off of this particular scroll that we're going to look at. Would someone want to read for me Revelation chapter 5 and verse 1? That's an easy, short verse. Okay, go ahead, Don.
And I saw on the right hand of him who sat on the throne a scroll written inside and on the back, sealed with 7 seals.
All right. So as we move out of the overview of Revelation, so you have the things that John describes that he saw, those Jesus on Patmos, and then he shows the present day for John, those 7 churches and so forth. Then he's taken up into heaven and he's shown the throne room of God. There's worship going on. There's no chaos, confusion like what we have on earth. But then the focus shifts. And of course, this is why I want you to understand chapter 5, is because you'll notice that the one who is seated on the throne, the him there, is still God. And in his right hand is a, some translations use book, some use scroll. It's a scroll in that time period. You know, they didn't have bound books like we would think of today. But the same idea, it's a book, but in particular, it's a scroll. If you have the handout and you look on the chart, what you'll see there is in that first one, it's a simple chart, and it's just showing the judgments, the 3 series of 7 judgments during the tribulation period. You notice that scroll that's there, and it has the 7 seals. That's what we're looking at there. So it gives you an idea, sort of a visual. God, imagine him having some type of scroll in his hand. The scroll is rolled up, and it's got 7 seals on it, and it's sealed and locked. And so we're trying to figure out what's the significance of it. Okay, so we see that there. Now, the first thing to understand about the scroll is God alone has the authority and the power over it. God owns it. It's his. The other thing to see, too, is, and of, there's really no way to, there's, well, there's several ways to interpret it, but we, it's a little ambiguous. What is interesting about the scroll, though, is there any room to be added anything to it? If you notice, it's written on the front and the back. It's full. It's kind of interesting. There's various interpretations to that. The idea there, of course, is nothing can be added to it, but it's full and it's complete. 7 in the Bible, what do we typically think of with 7? Yeah, perfection, completion. How many seals are on there? 7. So God's enthroned in heaven. He's got the scroll. He has the power and the authority over it. It's sealed with 7. What is the significance of it? Well, I'm going to tell you in just a second what the significance of it is. But before we do that, I'm going to read something to you. Maybe it'll help a little bit. David Levy has a commentary on Revelation. He makes this comment. It deals with that particular time. I think it'll help a little bit. He says, it was common in the first century for a person in authority to seal an important document so that its contents would remain secret. Roman law required a last will and testament to be sealed 7 times, as is illustrated in such individuals as Caesar Augustus. So the idea there is it fit the context too. In other words, the idea there is the document is important, it's sealed, and the contents remain secret until a particular period of time, and we're going to find out when that time comes. But the question comes up is, what is the significance of it? Because later you'll see what some of the content is. But what's the significance of it? So there's a couple of ways that people interpret this. In other words, they explain it. Most of the explanations are pretty much the same. They are just varied. You know, if you ever gotten a definition of something and it's sort of the same in each way, but they're all sort of nuanced, that's sort of the idea of the significance. In other words, what is this scroll? I'm going to read you my definition, then I'll give you 2 better ones, okay? And then I'll try to explain it a little bit. This is mine. The scroll represents Jesus' right to rule the earth as king because he paid the penalty for redemption, which redeems not only mankind, but creation itself. Part of reclaiming this rule involves judgment, which is what is the remaining portions of the book. That's just my way of understanding it. So you have this scroll, and in it you're going to see is it's a title deed. It gives authority to someone the right to rule and claim rulership over the earth. In order to do that, they have to meet certain criteria, and that's what we'll be looking at in a few minutes. read you two definitions, and they're similar. And then I'll see if you have any questions. This one comes from David Levy, and then I'm going to read one from John Walvoord. Levy says, "This scroll contains Christ's title deed to the earth by right of creation and redemption." What he means by that is, Jesus, of course, we know in the New Testament, he was God's agent, I like to call it, who brought about creation. Everything was brought into creation through Christ. Thus, since he created it, he has the right to rule and reign over it. That's his idea. But part of that reclaiming it is to redeem it. In Eden, what was lost? Well, salvation, of course, in other words, there was a need for salvation because what was lost, our relationship with God was lost, wasn't it? Corruption and so forth was here, isn't it? It's in the heart. But corruption is also on the earth. You understand? When Adam fell, everything fell. It wasn't as though he went out into perfect paradise, did he? He got kicked out of paradise. That's sort of the idea of what Levy is saying. It's a title deed is what it's typically referred to. But what does that title deed mean? It means that Christ has the right to rule in the reign, part of which because he created it, but also because he's redeemed it. He's redeemed it on the cross. And later in the book of Revelation, what does Jesus ultimately do? He redeems creation, doesn't he? So that's sort of the idea there. That's just his way of saying it. It's similar to what I said. This last one is by John Walvoord. He says, "If this is a will, it is a reference to the inheritance that Christ will receive from his Father, which is the kingdom, as seen in Psalm 2. Same idea. The idea is typically that it's a title deed, but people don't typically explain what that means. It means that Jesus has the right to rule and to reign because he brought forth and created everything and he had a purpose for it. Unfortunately, it has to be redeemed, doesn't it? And all of creation historically is pointing to Jesus redeeming it. He redeems you and I how? Through the cross. How is he going to one day, of course, redeem creation? And that's sort of some of the things you see later in the book. Does that help any there? Any questions before I move on? Okay. But if the right to do that is contingent on certain criteria, what is the criteria? And that's what we're going to look at in verses 2 through 5, because John says there's a problem. And the problem is that something needs to be solved, because otherwise the title deed can't be owned, it can't be established, it can't be redeemed, etc., etc., etc. Someone read for me verse 2 through where we'll stop tonight, which is in verse 5. Would someone want to read those verses? Chapter 5, verses 2 through 5.
"And I saw a strong angel proclaiming with a loud voice, 'Who is worthy to open the book? Has come to open the book and its seven seals.'"
Okay, so if you notice there's a problem, isn't there? So it's nice, there's a scroll there. It gives the person who takes it the right to rule, to reclaim authority over creation, to redeem not only mankind, but also creation, all of those things I talked about. But the problem is one particular word. Does anyone have a note or a guess on what that one particular word is that's emphasized here?
Worthy.
Yeah, right. It's in verse 4 because John weeps. Because John's sitting there thinking, okay, God the Father has the scroll in his hand. And there's no one anywhere. Have you ever wondered if salvation and so forth is exclusive? It's all through the Bible. And you'll notice you even see it here. Because no one anywhere, whether they're in heaven, on earth, under the earth, nowhere in all of creation can open it. But the, if you will, criteria is, notice, "Then I began to weep greatly because no one was worthy." That's really the key there to understanding the scroll. And then what we'll look at next time is this idea of worth or being worthy. In order to be worthy, someone has to be able to meet certain criteria. And there's only one person in all of creation that could meet these three criteria. And you'll see the three criteria in verse 5. Notice it says, "Stop weeping. Behold, the lion from the tribe of Judah." The first criteria to be worthy, to solve the problem, is that you must be from the Lion of the tribe of Judah. Where does that come from? Well, let me tell you. So let's turn back to Genesis 49. You're thinking, it takes that long to go back? I mean, we're all the way back in Genesis. We need to be make sure we're reading our Bibles, don't we? Genesis is important because God has a plan through history that he's working out, and he begins to narrow down the focus on who's going to bring redemption. Genesis 49, and I'll just read these briefly here. It's in verses 9 through 10. Verse 10 is the main verse. This is seen as a messianic prophecy. And you'll see in verse 9, it says, Judah is a lion's whelp. If you notice, that's where I'm looking at. But verse 10 is really the prophecy. That would be considered a messianic prophecy. Verse 10 says, the scepter shall not depart from Judah, and nor the ruler's staff from between his feet until Shiloh comes, and to him shall be the obedience of the peoples. This is, in short, the messianic prophecy, and what it's saying is that the Redeemer would be through the line of Judah. That's not the only place that it says it, but that's typically where you would start with it. And then as you go through the Old Testament, you'll see that there needs to be this Redeemer, but he must come from the tribe of Judah. Did Jesus come from the tribe of Judah? Of course, the answer is yes. Now, the next one, you don't have to turn back to Revelation for this. The second criteria is he has to be the root or the descendant of David. Let's turn to Isaiah 11. I'm giving you these as short answers. In other words, you could take, for instance, Genesis, you could take Isaiah and build off of it, but I'm just giving you a quick answer here in terms of what was being looked at. When the Messiah came, he would have to be from the tribe of Judah, but he also had to be a descendant from David. No exceptions. And that's much of what we see, for instance, in Matthew. But notice verse chapter 11 of Isaiah, verse 1. Then a shoot will spring from the stem of Jesse, and a branch from his roots will bear fruit. The idea there is that someone would come out of the lineage of King David, the stem of Jesse, Jesse being his father, of course, David's. And he says when that branch comes, he'll do what? He'll bear fruit. It's just one of many examples. Jesus, so we know he was from the tribe of Judah. Was he related in any way to David, or did he miss that? No, he was from the offspring, the lineage of David. One of the things in the book of Revelation is David, King David is mentioned in the book. In other words, the offspring of David. And this is one of those reasons. But I want you to look back with me before we try to summarize all this for this time. Go back with me to Revelation 5 and verse 5. Because I'll give you the third one. The third one we'll look in more detail next time. But at least in this verse, I want you to see it. So again, John is waiting before he's told what's coming future. God the Father has this scroll, the title deed, the right to rule, reign, redeem, and those things. But in order to do that, the problem has to be solved. The problem is there's no one who's worthy except one. And it's the one who comes from Judah, the offspring of David. But you'll notice the third one, that he has overcome. This is the idea, some translations refer to it as conquered. The idea there is that there was victory and redemption where? On the cross. Someone had to pay and purchase redemption for humanity, and only Jesus was the one who was able to do that. We'll see that next time in verse 6, for instance. So the reason why Jesus is worthy is what? He meets that three criteria that's listed there. There is others, but the three there is he has to be from Judah, which he was, David's offspring, which he is, but he also, most importantly, had to purchase and redeem those, of course, and pay the penalty for sin. That's what the rest of that is. That's why they sing those praises. That's why we sing praises, worthy is the Lamb who was what? Who was slain. It means to be butchered. And so that is what happens there. Now, next time, we'll look at the rest and we'll see how this worth, this worthy, this redemption has. And then there are these elders and then all of these angelic beings that worship the Lamb. But I want to give us two things, and then I'm going to read you something. If you want to read ahead for next time, verses 6 through 14, and that'll give us a good idea of what the scroll is, and then we'll see what the contents are following that. But two things, and then I'm going to read you something. The first is, while earth may be in chaos, the Lord rules peacefully and control in heaven. That's one of the things that I think people are so afraid of the book of Revelation. Do you understand? Even early on, what it's showing you is that God is in control even when the earth is in chaos. Do you think the earth is in chaos today? Is God taken aback by it? No, but we are. We shouldn't be. Two, only Jesus solves the problem of ruling, in other words, reclaiming the authority to rule on the earth, but most importantly is conquering. Only Jesus provides redemption. He is the only one who can redeem mankind. He's the only one who's going to be able to undo the curse that's on creation. That's what Paul talks about in Romans. This poem says, "Worthy, O Lamb of God, art thou, that every knee to thee should bow, worthy of ransomed sinners' praise. On Calvary's cross thy life blood flowed to pay the mighty debt we owed. O, who in heaven or on earth can utter all thy glorious worth?" That's sort of what I want you to see. Jesus is worthy, initially we see there, for redemptive purposes. He's going to be worthy later on when he redeems all of creation and rules. So that kind of gives us a foretaste of what we'll look at later. But does anybody have any questions or comments? I know it's a lot to digest. Whichever.